From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest is Patricia Siplon, political scientist and AIDS activist. Siplon will discuss her experiences with the HIV epidemic in Tanzania. She also describes the many ways that we in the U.S. are directly connected to the array of problems Tanzania faces, ranging from our agricultural policies to World Bank dictates that prevent African countries from building up their public health infrastructures. And we'll also look at what we in the U.S. can do to promote development and public health in sub-Saharan Africa. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The following news update was compiled by Public Health Radio's news editor, Andrew Coates. About half of the U.S. population lives within 10 miles of one of the 1,304 active and proposed Superfund cleanup sites listed by the Environmental Protection Agency. A report from the Center for Public Integrity highlights the dwindling funding of the Superfund under the Bush administration. The report points to the examples of sites that have been on the EPA National Priorities List for cleanup for years, but where the cleanup effort has not even begun. Among them are at Libby, Montana, where operation of a vermiculite mine was found to have caused the asbestos-related deaths of over 200 people. In Smelterville, Idaho, a lead smelter was implicated in the worst childhood lead poisoning epidemic in U.S. history. Many homes there are likely to have significant concentrations of lead, but have not even been studied. And more than 1 million pounds of highly toxic polychlorinated biphenyls were dumped by the General Electric Company into the Hudson River in upstate New York, but that cleanup has yet to be undertaken as well. The report also highlights the decision of the Bush administration to keep Superfund cleanup priorities and plans secret from the public. The report is available online at the website of the Center for Public Integrity, publicintegrity.org. On July 13th, members of the Senate Finance Committee tentatively agreed on a renewal and expansion of the state children's health insurance program, commonly known as SCIP. SCIP covers about 6 million children from families that are low income but not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. The bill would increase spending for SCIP to $60 billion over the next 5 years, $35 billion more than if it were extended in its current form. The extra spending would be financed with a 61-cent increase in the federal tobacco tax to $1 per pack. However, President Bush opposes the expansion. In a speech on July 10th, he indicated that the program is going beyond the initial intent of helping poor children. Instead, it's now aiming at encouraging more people to get on government health care. Bush spokesman Tony Fratto released a statement on July 14th that tax increases are neither necessary nor advisable to appropriately fund SCIP. But those who support the SCIP expansion saw little relationship between the child health insurance program and the availability of private health insurance coverage. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the proposed expansion of the SCIP program would provide health coverage to 3 million of the 10 million children in the U.S. who currently have no health insurance coverage. In May 2007, Michael Chertoff, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, announced that the United States would accept 7,000 Iraqi refugees by September of this year. Nearly 3 million Iraqis have fled the country, and more than 2 million have been internally displaced since the United States invaded in 2003. In the 2 months since this statement, the United States accepted only 133 refugees from Iraq, bringing the total number of Iraqis accepted as refugees into the U.S. since the start of the war to 831. A June 2007 report by Health Access California looked at the impact of high-deductible insurance on middle-class families. Around the United States, proposals for state-based reforms that mandate individuals to purchase health insurance tend to rely upon high deductibles to keep a lid on the costs of the health insurance policies. The authors, however, found that an individual mandate would have the opposite of its intended effect, and instead would expose middle-class families to even more financial burden. Their data demonstrate that a deductible of $5,000 would wipe out 40% of Californians, force them to sell their car, clear out their savings account, and empty out any retirement savings, leaving them with only whatever equity they have in their home. The report is available at the Health Access California website, healthaccess.org. Coming up next, a discussion on public health in Tanzania and how we in the U.S. are connected to the health crisis in sub-Saharan Africa. So stay with us. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. According to data from the United Nations AIDS program, approximately 40 million people are currently infected with the HIV virus, roughly 95% of them in the poor countries of the global south. Over 3 million people worldwide are dying of HIV infection every year, and over 500,000 of them are children. Since the onset of the epidemic 2 decades ago, 20 million people have died in sub-Saharan Africa alone. The number of AIDS deaths in Africa will soon surpass the 20 million people who died of the Black Death during the 14th century. AIDS is expected to slash overall economic activity in Africa by 25%. These colossal numbers can seem overwhelming, and the individuals who are impacted can feel very distant to those of us who live in the United States. But we in the U.S. are more connected to the tragic situation in sub-Saharan Africa than we may think. U.S. government policies, ranging from agricultural subsidies to policies at the International Monetary Fund, as well as our response to the nursing shortage in the U.S., all have palpable impacts on Africa. And no area of the world has been more adversely affected by global warming than southeastern Africa. Today's guest, Patricia Siplon, has explored the public health and economic crises in sub-Saharan Africa, both in her work as a political scientist and directly in the development work she is doing in Tanzania. Patricia Siplon is an associate professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. She has written many books and other publications on HIV-related policy and other development issues, highlighting the role women play both in their economies and in the HIV epidemic. She has won numerous awards, including a Fulbright Fellowship, in pursuit of her activities in Africa. In Tanzania, Dr. Siplon has provided technical support for several organizations advocating for people impacted by HIV. Recently, the Clinton Foundation funded a grant she developed to promote the expansion of the Elula Orphan Program, a project that supports orphans of the HIV epidemic in central Tanzania. Patricia Siplon, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
We often hear those who are working on preventing the spread of HIV emphasize that people who involve themselves in high-risk behaviors, sexual promiscuity or mainlining drugs, can contract HIV because the HIV virus doesn't know who's wealthy and who's poor. And of course, that's good advice, because that's certainly true. The virus can't tell who's being infected. But in your experiences in Africa and in your writing, you've written that actually there is a very great correlation between poverty and HIV infection, and that somehow it does end up mattering where someone is on the wealth scale in terms of both whether they get infected and what's going to happen once they do. And I was wondering if you could tell us about your experiences with that issue.
The circumstances that a person's in are one of the things that determine what their range of choices are around their behaviors in the first place. And a person who lives in a wealthy country who has relatively the same amount of power as the other people that they're interacting with and that they're having sex with or that they're engaging in other risk behaviors with are in a completely different situation than people in very poor situations where poverty drives a lot of the other things that they're doing. And so, for example, one of the things that people that study HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa have been pointing out in the last few years is that among teenagers generally and people in their early 20s, women have, in a lot of places, three times as high rates of HIV as men. And if the sexual partnering that was going on were between people in those two age ranges, then you would expect to see rates that were much closer together. And in fact, what's happening is that these younger women are sexually partnering with older men. And the reason that they're doing that is financial. It's older men that have the financial resources or that have power to determine opportunities, like do you get a job or do you get to go on to higher education? And so it's not that a girl is thinking, oh, I really want to have sex with this older man. It's that she's thinking, I really want to go to college or I really want to be able to support myself. And that's something that's really driven by economic circumstance. You can talk about the same thing when you're talking about a community and how they're coping with HIV. And again, the economic circumstances of the whole community winds up being a huge piece of what's driving the epidemic in the first place. So if you're talking about a place where people just don't have a lot of disposable income and don't have a lot of choice about how many more people they can afford to bring into their home or how many more people they can afford to take care of, then that's going to have a huge impact on that community's ability to do home-based care or that community's ability to take care of children who are orphaned by AIDS. And if people don't get good care, or if orphans don't get the services that they need, then they become still more vulnerable to the things that make HIV spread in the first place.
You even mentioned that for obtaining the most basic items like food and soap, basic items that we have in the household, that the depth of poverty in many of the countries that you work in Africa is so severe that young women may be forced to basically trade sex for resources or money that will allow them to purchase these basic items for their families.
A really good example comes from the community that I just came back from a couple of weeks ago. There was a group of students and other faculty from St. Mike's, and we were working at the orphan center there. And in that area, it's called Alula, there's been a very persistent drought for a number of years, and a lot of the villages simply don't have public water at all. The few that do, the taps run maybe twice a week, and people can get a really limited amount. And so what that's done is it's turned water into a cash commodity. And providing water in most of sub-Saharan Africa, it's the responsibility of women and girls to provide water that the household needs.
Why is that?
In a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, gender roles are still pretty rigid. The domestic sphere is the woman's sphere, and it's the expectation is she's going to be able to provide for it. And so women need to get the water for cooking, for cleaning, for laundry, for drinking. And yet there is no water. And so if there is no water, then you've got to buy it. And once again, the gender piece on the other side is that all the water vendors are men. And so you need to either get cash in order to exchange for the water, or you need to have something else to exchange for the water. And in either case, if you've got nothing else, what you're left with is your body. And so the first time I was in this area, which was 2005, I was there with another student, and we were doing some work on a grant for the community, and we went around and talked to people in 7 different villages, and all of them said over and over, it's water. The scarcity of water is what's driving the epidemic here. And at first, it didn't seem logical. It didn't seem like that could be true. And now I believe it. I've heard it over and over, and I've seen it myself.
In terms of the water issue, you've mentioned that the need for a certain level of per capita water consumption in a household, in other words, if there's 6 people in the household rather than 4, the family might need more water, and it might actually impact a decision for the family as to whether to take in orphans, presumably many of them HIV orphans. Is that actually the case?
The level of generosity in these villages is astoundingly high. And when I was here on this last trip, that was one of the things that we were documenting, is just how many people are fostering orphans in their home, because it's an astonishing number. Something that we don't think about here is that somebody that's in an advanced stage of HIV disease, especially if it's untreated or if they're not responding to treatment anymore, it's really common for them to have really serious digestive problems, and they'll be vomiting and they'll have a lot of diarrhea. And if you're in a situation where maybe the family has one sheet or a couple pieces of cloth, then the only way to take care of that patient is just to wash that one sheet or those few pieces of cloth over and over. And that takes a level of water resource that people just don't have. So water itself becomes a tipping point where people have to kind of make a decision, can our household sustain the needs of this person who's coming into it that then inherently is going to have a higher level of need? You see really often people walking very long distances, again, women and girls almost exclusively, with 20-liter jerry cans, in Swahili they're called debes, that they carry on their heads. So they'll go to a creek or some kind of water source and fill it and then walk back maybe 2 or 3 kilometers with the debe on their head. It takes a long time, and it's obviously pretty difficult. Another thing to keep in mind is that very poor areas, people don't have shoes, so you're walking barefoot this whole time. And the other thing about it that has gotten worse is, again, because of environmental problems, because of the global warming that has created the drought, and because of the need for resources, there's been really severe deforestation in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, including the area I was in. So what the government of Tanzania recently did was basically outlaw cutting down trees in public areas, which from an environmental perspective needed to happen, but the way they did it was really draconian. They just changed the law. And all of these people that had used these trees as a source of fuel, suddenly they couldn't. And a lot of people make their living making charcoal out of them, and they lost their living as well. So what that has done is drive the price of wood and charcoal up exponentially. And what it has meant is that this water that comes from unsafe sources to begin with very often isn't boiled because you can't. You can't afford the charcoal that you would need to boil it. And so that, in turn, drives up the whole problem of disease because you have people that are drinking unsafe water. And in that same way, if you've got somebody who's on treatment, for example, they're getting antiretrovirals now for HIV, they need to have clean water to take them with, and in a lot of cases, they simply don't.
So the drinking water and the water that people use in their homes is often contaminated, but also when you're taking care of someone with HIV infection, let me just say it this way, if HIV-infected patients were in a hospital in the United States, all of the items used to treat them would be considered hazardous waste and would be sterilized. And yet, what you're saying is that an HIV-infected person in Africa, that it's a struggle just to even clean their linen, and the process of doing that would hardly be something that would meet infectious control standards here. I mean, it would be, it's a completely different level, it sounds
like. Absolutely. Another thing that's happening all over sub-Saharan Africa, and again, definitely in the place where I was, what HIV is doing is it's gutting the adult population. So what you're left with is elderly people and children. The Swahili word for grandmother is bibi, and everybody in the area I was in talked about the fact that the bibis are basically left to take care of everything. They have these grandchildren that are left with them. They don't have any source of income. Physically, it's very, very difficult for them to acquire water, because all the things we talked about in terms of where they could get water from are sort of less likely as sources, and for them to walk 3 kilometers barefoot when they're 75 years old is even more difficult. And I remember when I was there last summer talking to a bibi who's very certain that she herself became HIV positive caring for her daughter who was dying. And again, at first I sort of thought, oh, you know, that can't happen. That's the casual transmission we're always talking about here in the U.S. is not a risk. But there, because people don't have any way of maintaining any kind of universal precautions, there's certainly no gloves, there's no rubber sheeting, there's no way of disposing of contaminated things. There's really just a lot of very intimate contact when you're taking care of somebody who's dying. I think it is happening that people are being exposed.
If an individual providing care for a person with advanced AIDS is having to be there for the person and fetch water, keep everything clean, how do people then earn money? It was my assumption that in many of the rural villages in sub-Saharan Africa, people were spending long hours in the fields. So I guess the question is, how do you earn money if you're having to spend all this time fetching water to take care of? So many people are taking care of the people affected by the HIV epidemic.
The short answer is you don't.
I mean, the economy must be ruined because of this.
There's a couple of things that are going on. One of them, again, goes back to the water and the fact that this is a vicious cycle where the water sources get further degraded. In the area I was in, the main cash crop is tomatoes. And because water sources have become so scarce and because people are, frankly, so strapped for time and energy, what they do now is anybody who can afford to grow tomatoes grows them absolutely as close to the water source as possible, and in some cases literally in the riverbeds. And because they want to be able to sell their tomatoes, they want them to be as high quality as possible, so they use pesticides on them. So they're dumping the pesticides literally into the riverbeds, which makes the water that's being drawn from those same riverbeds poisonous and furthers the whole cycle of disease. This last trip, one of the things some of the students and I were doing was interviewing some of the bibis and also some of the girls who had come to the orphan center. We talked to the bibis about how were they trying to make a living, and the girls at the orphan center, you know, how did you support yourself before you came here? And the girls that we talked to, and in a lot of cases these were really young girls, weren't going to school at all. They would be sent out into somebody else's field and told to work there all day to try to make enough money so that they could bring home money to their guardian, so that basically they were earning at least some of their keep. And we asked them really specific questions, like, how often did you eat? What kinds of, you know, where'd you get your water from? Where, how many people slept in the bed that you slept in? And the answers we got were really stark ones. We ate once a day. The food was the same food every single day. The water we got came from the place that we walked 2 kilometers to get it. No, we never boiled it. We slept 4 people on a mattress on a floor, and that was their life. I remember one afternoon we went to see 2 different BBs, and we asked them both, how are you making it? And both of them are being supported by the program that we were there working with, and one of them said that. She said, once a month, I get my bag of cornmeal, and they've helped me rebuild my mud hut. And that was her answer for how was she supporting herself. The other one didn't say anything at first, and then when we pushed her a little bit, she said that she brews local beer and makes this local kind of alcohol and sells it in the local community.
Tell me about your work there. What in what context are you working there? You just mentioned that you're part of a program that sounds like it's providing aid.
The program that I work with is called the Alula Orphan Program, and I learned about it when I was there in 2005, and a friend of a friend told me about it, and I went with a St. Mike's student to go check it out, and we were just enormously impressed. And we came back to the capital city of Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and we wanted to tell all the donors about it. Say, everybody has to go out to this program. It's so great. And one of the big donors in Tanzania is the Clinton Foundation that President Clinton has set up. And they were kind of interested, and they were looking for a place to start a rural HIV/AIDS treatment site. And they said, if you write us a proposal, we might be interested in that. And so I was there actually at that time on a Fulbright, and I was working with another student. So we went back out to Alula, and we wrote the grant proposal for the Alula Orphan Program and the local hospital there. And so the Clinton Foundation picked them both up and made the Lutheran Health Center a rural treatment site and helped the Alula Orphan Program actually open the doors of the orphan center, because at that point it was just a building. And they gave them the money to finance running it for the first 2 years. And I've been in pretty close contact with them ever since, went back to visit once, and now they're running up against the end of that grant, and they really need some more support. And they also run these other programs. They run a sponsorship program to keep kids in school. They run a foster family program. They run a preschool, all these great programs. And so this time, my husband Todd and I and another professor here at St. Mike's, Jerry Swope, in the journalism department, took 10 students, half of them journalism students, half of them students that have worked with me in HIV/AIDS projects, and we went back out for 3 weeks, and we wrote some grant applications, and we're right now finishing a website for the Alula Orphan Program, and we're making a film for them. And so that's basically the summer's work, is finishing that stuff out.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Patricia Siplon, and we've been discussing her work in Tanzania, one of the countries most heavily impacted by the HIV epidemic. After the break, we'll look at the actions of the U.S. government, both currently and in the past, that have impacted health and development in Tanzania and other countries of sub-Saharan Africa. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Patricia Siplon, a political scientist and health activist who serves on the faculty of St. Michael's College in Vermont. Before the break, we were discussing how we in the U.S. are impacting the economic and public health situation in sub-Saharan Africa. Now back to the interview. So it sounds like the healthcare system in Tanzania and presumably other countries of sub-Saharan Africa is so underfunded that they end up depending on grants which are of finite duration. It sounds like it's exactly what you're saying. And the very people who may most need the grant are not going to be probably literate enough or even, I don't know, have computers available to come up with an elaborate, elegant grant application. I mean, it seems to me to be the ultimate irony.
Yeah.
That you happen to be Western and obviously highly educated, so you can do that for them, but it seems unlikely that's available all over sub-Saharan Africa.
It's sort of an interesting conundrum, I think, that the only silver lining that I see coming out of the AIDS pandemic is that it's focused a lot of attention on just how dire conditions are in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that potentially that could be a good thing if it were coupled with a clear understanding of why some of those situations are so dire and what the West's responsibilities are in some of those areas. And so, for example, something that I think the Tanzanian government and a lot of sub-Saharan governments should be really applauded for is that they have stepped up and they've said, we are going to do treatment in our countries, and we're going to get the cheapest available drugs, and we're going to roll out these programs. And in places like Tanzania, they're even rolling them out in rural areas now. And I think that's great. What it's exposing is the fact that, especially in the rural areas, there's no healthcare infrastructure. And that's partly the fault of the government that they haven't put the resources into it, but I think it's much more the fault of the donor community, because not only have we not helped them put the resources into it, but in a lot of cases we've affirmatively kept them from doing that. The IMF and the World Bank, that a lot of these countries depend on, have created policies that say you cannot spend more than a certain amount of money on healthcare. Another thing that the IMF has specifically done is said...
The
International Monetary Fund has specifically told a lot of developing countries that they cannot spend over a certain cap on healthcare worker salaries. And what that has done is contributed enormously to a global problem that is a global brain drain.
You've pointed out in your writings that while the HIV epidemic and the economic disasters in sub-Saharan Africa can seem very far from our lives here in the U.S., from our personal lives, and people feel frustrated that they don't know how what they can do, and they don't know how our lives relate to their lives, but you're starting to point out that, in fact, we're connected. If I'm not mistaken, the International Monetary Fund is pretty much controlled by the wealthy countries. And it sounded like you're now getting into another way that we're connected to them with this phenomenon of brain drain, where the most highly educated people in Africa, perhaps doctors, nurses, and other important types of workers, end up leaving those countries. And I was wondering if you could talk about that. What is our role in that? Are we actually complicit in that?
I think we're completely complicit in it, and in a number of ways. The first one is that I think a lot of people notice if they go to an American hospital, or if you're in Europe and you're in a hospital in the UK, you notice that a lot of the healthcare workers there aren't natives of the country. But I don't think that very many people stop and think about what that means for the country that those people came from. And in a place like Tanzania, most of the doctors and a lot of the nurses are people that the government itself has invested in. Most of the doctors have their tuition paid for by the government because the government knows that the country needs doctors. Tanzania has 2 medical schools for the entire country. I think they're opening a third now, for a country of more than 35 million people. So the government recruits their best and brightest, sends them to medical school, and then what happens is they get out of medical school, they look for a job, and their choices are to work in the public sector, which is enormously underfunded and enormously overworked.
And you mentioned that there may even be salary caps.
Yes. They know that their salary will be capped at a frankly, pretty obscenely low level. I know doctors that are making $200 a month. The lowest I heard of was somebody that was closer to 100. And in some places, what those caps are doing is also limiting how many people can even be employed. And in Kenya, for example, a pretty notorious case, the Kenyan government was told that they have a severe nursing shortage, but they were limited on how many nurses they could even be put in the public sector by the IMF and the World Bank. The argument of the IMF and the World Bank is that if you do this government spending, and especially if you increase the salaries, you will create inflation problems. So these doctors look around. They see that their options in their own country are limited to none, and there are recruiters coming from the United States and the UK and other countries saying, you know, come over here and earn, I mean, not double, not triple, you know, 20 times, 30 times, 40 times the amount of money that you can make at home. And even if we have to hire you as a nurse and you're a trained doctor, you'll make so much more money. And so these best and the brightest leave. They look around, they look at their own families, and they feel like, you know, what choice do I have? And what that does is it's not only that the patients that they need to be serving aren't getting the care, it's also, frankly, a ripoff of developing countries' governments, the governments of the world who can least afford to pay for these high levels of training, are paying them and then handing their most highly trained, most highly skilled workers to the United States, who just got them trained for free, or to the UK, or to whoever. By not training enough nurses, what we're doing is making it so that some clinic in sub-Saharan Africa just goes completely unstaffed. I think that's an example of a place where we are just absolutely directly complicit. Another thing that has really been driven home to me in this going back and forth to Alula is that anybody who thinks that their contributions to global warming are a personal issue is completely delusional. The global warming impacts that are creating droughts in places like Alula are fueling the HIV/AIDS pandemic. They're fueling all kinds of other health problems, and they're just fueling the immiseration of millions of people's lives.
You've written that another connection that we often don't think about is historical. Many of the poor countries around the world experienced many decades or even centuries of colonization by Britain, France, the U.S., and some other wealthy countries. Slavery was practiced in many of these areas. And a lot of us might think of the colonial period as ancient history. Much of it ended 50 or 60 years ago. But you've pointed out that there may be a legacy that decades later that still has an impact and may continue to. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
I think there's the general impact and then a lot of specific ones. And the general impact that I think is pretty undeniable is the power inequity that got left over. I don't know how anybody can argue that Western rich countries control the global agenda, and they decide what the important issues are, and they also decide what the solutions are to even problems that poor countries are facing. That's because they became the rich countries, and they did it in large part on the back of slavery and labor and resources that were extorted from colonial states. But in terms of the specifics and in terms of what's still ongoing, one of the things that happened because of colonialization is that most of the developing countries, including most of the sub-Saharan African countries, when they were colonized, were agricultural economies. Most of them still are agricultural economies. But what changed was what was farmed. And what used to be farmed was whatever crops were best suited to local conditions and which fulfilled local needs. What happened when these areas were colonized is that what was farmed was what there was a market for in Western countries. So instead of having lots of little peasant farmers working their own plots, growing local vegetables and local grains, what happened instead is that you would organize huge plantations that would be owned by colonizers and impose taxes on the local people. The only way that they could pay their taxes was to get cash. And the only way that they could get cash was to earn wages on the colonial plantations. And so you went from this situation where people were growing their own individual crops to they were growing as wage laborers on plantations, and the plantations would grow things like coffee or tea, in some cases cotton. And what would often happen is that in an individual country, you would get it down to one or two cash crops. The problem with that was that, first of all, it then created a power dynamic within the colony where you'd have a few people who owned large tracts of land, usually people of European descent, who controlled the local economy. But also, even among people who were able to grow those crops on their own as locals, they're totally at the whims of not the local economy, but the global economy. So, for example, when I was there in 2002, I went with a close friend of mine up to his village in the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro, and his family had been forced to stop growing their local crops and grow coffee, because that's the cash crop for northern Tanzania. And when the bottom fell out of the coffee market, because the IMF and World Bank were counseling lots of countries to grow coffee so that they could export it and get U.S. dollars and European euros to pay off their debt to the IMF and World Bank. The market got flooded with coffee, and coffee became practically worthless. And people like my friend's family didn't even bother to grow their coffee anymore or harvest it because it cost more to maintain the coffee than it did what they would get when they went to the market to sell it. So I think that's a good example of really direct, continuing situation where what we've done to retool the economy is having a continuing effect all the time. Another one is the fact that now that we've organized the global economy in this kind of way, the other place where we don't play fair at all is in subsidizing our crops here in the U.S. And a really good example that pertains to sub-Saharan Africa is cotton. The amount of money that we use to subsidize our cotton farmers here in the United States is far greater than the amount of money that we give in aid to sub-Saharan Africa, all of sub-Saharan Africa, all forms of aid. And so what that winds up doing is allowing our farmers to put cotton on the global economy at a price that is less expensive than the cotton that comes, for example, from a country like Ghana. It actually costs less to grow cotton in Ghana if you take the subsidies away, but if you put the subsidies in, we're selling it for less. And so what the net effect is that we're driving poor farmers in places like sub-Saharan Africa out of business in order to subsidize gigantic industrial farms here in the U.S.
You also mentioned that in response to these monoculture-type agricultural systems, that workers often can't stay with their families because they need to migrate. I was wondering what that might mean.
It's a really serious problem, and an even better example than the migrant labor around agriculture is the one that has developed around mining, which is one of the other major ways that the economies of sub-Saharan Africa have been retooled. So what winds up happening is that you have these mines. Once again, they're owned almost exclusively by non-natives, and the countries give very, very good contracts to the mining companies because they see it as a way of gaining money from other countries that they can use to pay their debt. And then you have, for example, in Tanzania, there's gold mines and there's some tanzanite mines. And so men from around the country will go there to get work because it's fairly high paying because it's very dangerous. And in order to maximize the money they make, they just stay there. The mining companies do not allow families to come. And what they do is they put the men most cost-effective way possible in cramped hostels where there are many men bunk beds in little rooms. And then they just work them in the mines. And not surprisingly, women in the area view this as a possible way of supporting themselves. So you tend to have a pretty thriving sex trade around the mining areas, and there tends to be pretty high prevalence among the men that are working there.
Prevalence of HIV, is that what you're
saying?
Yeah,
prevalence of HIV. The men go home maybe once or twice a year, maybe at Easter and Christmas, and they bring the HIV back to the villages with them. It's a pattern that you see again and again in Southern Africa and in East Africa.
It sounds to me that when the formal system of colonization ended during the period after World War II, it sounds like it was replaced by a new system of predictably creating debt that these countries were encouraged to take on and in many cases couldn't avoid, and that we transformed control from direct maybe ownership of the countries over to control via credit and international organizations like the International Monetary Fund. Is that true? Do you look at it that way?
That's the way I look at it, absolutely. I teach a class most years on issues in sub-Saharan Africa, and one of the things that I often hear from students when they come into the class is, it's not our fault if some country picks an evil, nasty dictator that takes a bunch of IMF and World Bank loans and puts them in a Swiss bank account. You know, why is that our problem? Why is that our fault? And I think there's a couple things to think about there. In some cases, I do think it is absolutely our fault, because I think that the other thing that we don't have a very good historical memory about is that the decolonization of Africa and a lot of the rest of the world happen in the context of the Cold War. So the issue from the perspective of the United States and, to a lesser extent, Western Europe was not, will these countries be taken over by enlightened leaders who will think through what is in the best interest of their fellow citizens? It was, will these countries be taken over by people who will reliably be anti-communist? And I think a really interesting contrasting case study is to look at the way that the United States dealt with the countries of Democratic Republic of Congo and Tanzania. The first president of Tanzania was a man named Julius Nyerere, who is revered not only in Tanzania, but in most of sub-Saharan Africa as one of the most enlightened leaders out of his century. He was a teacher. He hugely promoted education and for a number of years created one of the highest literacy rates in sub-Saharan Africa, including among adult citizens who had never had the opportunity to go to school. He decentralized the health system to try to make sure that everybody had primary health care. And in a country where there were over 100 ethnic groups presided over all of the years of his presidency with no significant ethnic conflict or ethnic violence. The United States didn't like him because he was socialist, and he took aid from a number of countries, including healthcare aid from Cuba and development aid from China, and so the United States had extremely poor relations with him, and we didn't give much aid to the country of Tanzania during that time. Go across the border to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and what you get during the same period of time is one of the worst, most bloodthirsty dictators of the same period of time, who was Mobutu Sese Seko, who's perhaps the only thing you could say in his stead from the perspective of an American is that he was staunchly anti-communist. He had one of the worst human rights records probably of the century, and he presided over the complete robbery of his own country, took all of the loans that were given to him and stuck them in Swiss bank accounts, had huge amounts of corruption, huge amounts of theft from the mines and the mineral resources of the country, and the country's still a basket case to this day. And I think that it's absolutely true that the United States has a lot to answer for in the fact that they chose to back this horrible dictatorial leader, and they chose to distance themselves from a leader who was seen in sub-Saharan Africa as one of the most enlightened they've ever had. And so I think part of the issue, if you sort of think about it historically, is that we did play politics all over sub-Saharan Africa, and the litmus test we used was, were you willing to be anti-communist? It wasn't whether you were democratic. It wasn't whether you cared about human rights. It wasn't whether you cared about the development of your people. And people are still living with that legacy to this day.
You've mentioned the political realm as one area where we dominated Africa in a fairly dysfunctional ways, both before and then after the colonial period. Also, in your writings, you've discussed how colonialization affected basic infrastructure, for example, transportation and healthcare. And so maybe describe how that has had adverse impacts on these former colonies, like Tanzania.
When you go in as a colonial power, the reason that you create a colony in the first place is to extract the resources of the colony. And so if you're going to do that in the most efficient way, then you organize things to maximize that extraction. So the way that got translated into the administration of the colonies was twofold. One was to create urban centers where the administrators of that colony, the white people who came from the colonial powers, would have a reasonably pleasant place to live. And so if you go into the capital cities of most sub-Saharan African countries, and Dar es Salaam is a good example, you find that the city itself is ethnically divided and that there will be an area where probably to this day the Western expat community lives. And what you will always find is that there's a whole different standard of housing, that housing all has running water and electricity, that there will be at least one good hospital in that area, there will be at least one and usually a network of good schools, and just sort of a whole set of institutions that closely mirror the standard of living of the country that the colonial expats came from. And so when the colonialists set up the system, that's where they put their emphasis on the infrastructure, is creating those enclaves within the major cities. So usually in any country, you'll find at least one pretty decent hospital, and it will always be in the colonial city, and it will always be primarily available to expats and the elite of that country. What you will not find, dating back to that colonial legacy, is a decentralized system where there has been an honest attempt to spread that excellence outward, and where you'll see excellent standards of care or excellent standards of education going in far-flung areas of the country. Then the other piece is, again, because you're setting it up to be an efficient system of extraction, that's the way that you set up the transportation infrastructure. And so you don't see a network of good roads. You don't see a network of good communications. You see only roads that connect areas where things are being extracted, like a mining area or major plantation area, to the major metropolitan area, which is usually along a port. And so the issue is not how do you connect citizens with other citizens in ways that will better their lives. The issue is how do you connect the point where you're extracting the resources to the point where you're taking them out of the country. And if you look at a map of sub-Saharan Africa, you see it over and over. Like, take a look at the major roads. And the major roads will go from a mining area to the port area, from the plantation area to the port area. That's it.
You just returned from another trip to Africa just a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what any observations you might have made on this trip that were striking to you or that were maybe different from what you've seen in the past.
Good question. It always takes me a little time to sort of process, and I'm maybe still in that a little bit. I have more of an appreciation for the fact that a small group of people can do what the Alula Orphan Program did and really radically affect a lot of people's lives. One of the people that helped found the Alula Orphan Program is a woman named Barrett Scar. There's a maxim about, in answer to the question of who's the most important person, it's the person right in front of you. And when you're with her, you really think that. She's very focused in this one corner of the world.
Where's she from?
She's originally Norwegian. Hmm. She's a dual citizen in Norway and the United States. But when you're with her, it's really true. You go around in these villages, and it takes forever because you go to this person's little shop, and you go to this kid's house and meet his grandmother, and then you do this, and then you do that. And it really gave me an appreciation for just how important it is to remember that every single person is important. And I think that that's one of the reasons that I and a lot of other people are drawn to this particular project, is because the people from the community that are leading it up and the people that have sort of provided the ideas of it really believe that, and they really live it, that every person, the person in front of you, is really important. And so, yeah, I think that was sort of the take-home message that I got out of this one.
But all those people in the villages in Tanzania are not directly in front of us. Most of the listeners will never actually get to meet any of them, probably. And you've mentioned so many connections between what our government does and what we as individuals may or may not do, and how we're really connected to them. And just to give some examples, you've mentioned the importance of agricultural subsidies within our own country, of our own agricultural sector, cotton and sugar and other sectors. You talked about our foreign policy, which leaders we choose to support and for what reasons, with what impacts on those countries. You've talked about global warming as having really devastating impacts to certain poorer parts of the world. You talked about brain drain, and I assume you could talk about aid. There's so many ways we do impact those countries, but listeners might feel like they don't know how they can impact any of those things. So keeping in mind that the child in Tanzania, in that little village in Tanzania, who was right in front of you just a few weeks ago, what would you like to see our listeners do?
Oh, that's such a great question. A bunch of things. I think that there's a ton of opportunities that are right in front of us. One of them that's coming up that's very close at hand is that we're entering into a presidential election cycle that's probably the most wide open just in decades. We don't know who it's going to be. And there's a lot of candidates. And And the things that they say they care about are going to be enormously dictated by the things that they hear about a lot on the front end of the cycle. And so I think that one really tangible way that people can impact things right here, right now, is to go to New Hampshire, where there many of them are, in the next 6 months, and say, I don't just care about people in the United States. I care about people around the world, and I especially care about people who are the most vulnerable, and I want you to as well. What are you going to do? Another is to take a look and see how our members of Congress are doing. The first step is check out people's voting records and see whether, when they are asked to cast a vote, they're thinking about the most vulnerable people in the world, or they're only thinking about some mega business that doesn't really need a bunch of aid. It's not just that you need to vote the right way, it's also that you need to make these important issues. And the only way that questions about global warming, questions about the brain drain, questions about really creating aid systems that can have a tangible impact, questions about moving out of corporate subsidies into general aid, the only way that they move up on the political agenda is if politicians feel like they're going to have the support of voters if they stick their necks out and say, I care about this. And so I think that all of us have an obligation not just to say, I'm watching how you vote, I'm also watching to see what your priorities are. There's a number of very specific things that are being looked at right now. The U.S. government has a plan for AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. It's called the PEPFAR, the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It has been in operation for about 5 years, and now it is being reauthorized. And Congress and the President need to hear that people actually care about it, and that there's literally millions of people. There's more than 40 million people who are living with HIV right now. And for a lot of them, their best shot at getting treatment and getting some care is having a good reauthorization of PEPFAR. And in that same light, there are also United Nations programs. One of the biggest is called the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And the United States needs to lead the way on that. They need to give their fair share of the money. They need to not just hide behind the PEPFAR and say, this is the only thing we have to do. And the only way that, again, the government is going to step up on that is if they hear from citizens who say, we'd really like you to do that. So those are some really tangible ones, I think.
Well, Patricia Siplon, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you.
Listeners who would like to learn more about the Ilula Orphan Program should check out their website, IlulaOrphanProgram.org, and Ilula is spelled I-L-U-L-A. Donations to the program are enormously helpful, especially to become a sustainer who supports a child's education on an ongoing basis. The Health Global Access Project is one of the leading activist organizations working to improve health systems in the Global South, with a particular emphasis on the needs of HIV-infected patients in sub-Saharan Africa. Their website is healthgap.org. These links are included in the Public Health Radio website. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.